It's time for the Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. The views expressed on the Financial Cafe are those of the hosts and do not represent the views of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the SIU Board of Trustees, or WSIE Radio. Securities offered through Nickel Investors Corporation at No. 1 Executive Park, Granite City, Illinois, member FINRA and SIPC.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
I'd be rich.
And now, welcome to the Financial Cafe and our hosts, Larry Lexo and John Graney.
Good morning, John Graney.
Good morning, Larry Lexo. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful today. It was a nice spring day yesterday.
So spring, I felt like summer.
It was, well, you know, 80s is kind of
like
summer.
Summer.
I'll take it, though. You know, I like summer much better than pretty much any other season, but I guess technically it's the first day of spring. So
I'm a spring and fall guy. I don't like extremes, as you well know. So winter and summers do not appeal to me as much as spring and fall. But we had a really great fall. Spring is usually like just one day, and then all of a sudden it's summer
gets
here in St.
Hot,
Louis.
Yeah. Welcome to the Midwest. Yes, indeed. Well, and we do want to thank the Chef Shop. I'm hoping they're having a wonderful spring.
Drinking their coffee right now, the creme brulee.
The creme brulee. How do you like that one, John?
It is delicious.
Got that creamy caramelized double vanilla custard infused with the finest Arabica coffee.
Arabica.
I like saying Arabica.
You know, there's two beans, Arabica and Robusto. Starbucks serves the Robusto, which is the stronger, taste burnt flavor.
Mm.
And the Arabica is the smoother bean.
That's why I'm not
in
a
case
big,
you were wondering, you look like you had that confusion on your face when you said Arabica. I wish I knew more about coffee beans, and I'm here to help you.
Well, I hope you know more about what we do than that. So.
I got, well, it is the Financial Cafe, so I got the cafe part.
That's true. That is true.
Will be relying on your expertise when we get to the topic of the week segment.
Topic of the week.
We will be talking about disability insurance, and we may get into some long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry Lexo is much more knowledgeable on these issues than I am. So I'll play a little devil's advocate with him and be prompting him with questions. But you're more likely to become disabled than you are to die.
No question about that, John. And I'll be glad when we get past this month because it's March. It's the month of unexpecteds, you know, and disability.
Bringing you down.
Right, yeah, disability is one of those things that most people don't expect to become disabled. Of course, most people don't expect to die either. But the likelihood of a disability, whether it's partial or permanent, is extremely high. Especially compared to the risk of dying. So we'll get more into the facts and figures as we go forward. But, yeah, I'll be glad when we get past this month because it is kind of a downer. You know, we're talking about wills and trusts. We're talking about, you know, estate planning. We're talking about divorce. We're talking about disability. I mean, what else can happen to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're all important. They are all critical to a good financial plan, and that's
right,
why we're
and
here.
If you have the right things in place, should one of those unfortunate issues occur, you're in a better position to handle it. It's not as stressful for you. And again, it all comes down to planning, something that we talk about every week here on the show. But for In the Market, I came across an article that, you know, rates are going up. The Fed just raised them again just recently.
They did.
And it's the article was 7 Surprising Benefits of higher interest rates from the Federal Reserve.
Well, hopefully. I like benefits.
But I did want to go through each one of these 7 and just kind of temper the optimism here because I don't want people thinking that, oh, rates are going up, I can leave my investments in a money market fund. They're not going up fast enough. and the rate that you're getting on that investment will never keep up with inflation, even with the inflation that the government tells us. And
never, even though with a fictitious inflation rate.
So exactly. And, you know, Larry knows I have a bit of conspiracy theorist in me. I'm a very skeptical person. I grew up on the East Coast. The East Coast really should be the show me state. You know, you got to prove it. But the first point they talk about is higher returns. Yes, when interest rates go up, your short-term instruments will be affected first, and those rates will go up. So your short-term CDs that mature within 6 months or so, you'll see that bump up the next time you renew it. But if you're going from 1% to 1.5%, and yes, you're moving in the right direction, but even using the government statistic for inflation, you're not going to be keeping up with it. So it should be part of your portfolio, part of the capital preservation piece, but you should not think that 1.5%, you get your statement, I didn't lose any money, that things are going well, because you're losing purchasing power. The website that I like to use, and
write it down. Everybody get a pad, get a pen, write this down.
You can take this either way. I always look at both sides of a story and am very willing to admit that the truth usually lies in the middle. So I'm not going to take the government's word that inflation is at 2%. And John Williams has a website. It's called Shadow Government Statistics. And he has been tracking the inflation number pre 1980. So there was a method that the government used to calculate inflation before 1980. And then pre-1990, they changed it again. Larry, why would you think that the government would be changing the way they calculate inflation?
Well, I think the name of his website kind of spells it out. Shadow government. It's a way the government is able to manipulate people and to make them feel better about lower inflation. And also definitely has something to do with our national debt.
Exactly. Ding, ding, ding. That is the answer I was looking for.
Yep.
Folks, our debt is approaching $20 trillion.
Ouch.
And right now, the interest, and I contend that the government has been holding interest rates low, have been coming up with these different ways to calculate inflation to make it artificially low. One, because people don't get reelected when interest rates are high, inflation is high. And two, the amount of money that the government has to pay in interest payments, if that number gets higher and higher, it becomes a bigger and bigger problem for the government. But pre-1980, if you use the method that the government used to calculate inflation back then, would be north of 10%. You're getting probably about 10.5% looking at this chart here. If you go back to 1990, when they make the change in 1990, it would be north of 6%. So you can see that they keep adjusting the formula as they get lower and lower, or gets closer and closer to where we are today. So the government needs to artificially keep inflation down. The way companies have been addressing this, and this is something you can go out and Google, shrinkflation. And you will see how the government how companies have been addressing it, because they don't want to raise the cost of their product, because then they don't sell much of their product, so they just have been shrinking the size. Your 5-pound bag of sugar is now 4 pounds. tamed inflation is item number 2 in this article, and I think we just kind of dispelled that for a little bit. Something else to keep in mind for us retirees out there, you're the ones that are getting hit the hardest, because your portfolio is obviously going to be more conservative, but your Social Security benefit for the past 2 years has only been adjusted by a positive 0.3%. There was no adjustment.
Wow.
There was no adjustment in 2016, and the adjustment for 2017 is 0.3%. So that benefit is not keeping up with inflation, and that just goes to prove that the government is artificially creating these numbers because they can't afford to pay what we should be adjusting this by. One of the other points that it made was more lending. I'm not sure about that. Yes, the banks may be able to run their models and say, yes, we can take on some additional risk because we're getting paid more, but the rates aren't going up that quickly. And given the financial crisis that we went through, I think banks have enacted tougher standards and criteria before they can lend money. And, you know, we had Mr. Pickrow in here, the small business lender, and, you know, he said that it's a little tougher to get loans now. More interest for retirees. We just talked about that. That is not a – yes, you're going to get more interest, but it certainly is not enough to keep up with inflation here. Now, the last three I think are going to be interesting because the next one is a stronger dollar. And, Larry, you and I have talked about this year that this is a year of competing forces. Yes, President Trump wants to reduce taxes. That's along with the Obamacare, that is two of his bigger initiatives. I don't know how he can reduce taxes with the debt going up. He's got to keep revenues up in order for that to work. If the dollar continues to stay strong, that will conflict with his goal of trying to weaken the dollar so we can export and create more jobs here domestically. So that one's a tough one. That one would be nice to see which one wins out. I don't think we'll see anything for a couple years because it's going to take a while for these policies to have an impact. The sixth point in this article says stocks will trade on fundamentals. I about laughed when I read that one.
That is a good one.
I can't remember the last time stocks really traded on fundamentals. The markets are so emotional now. So they trade on emotion and they adjust on reality and fundamentals.
Thinking back, I mean, I have to go back the 90s. You know, we had the tech bubble, which was totally irrational and burst in 1999 into 2000. If you go back into the 80s, you know, interest rates approached 15% for loans and CDs, which was great if you got some locked in for a long period of time. Unfortunately, I don't know a lot of people that had the foresight to do that or the banks were willing to do that. And even going back to the 70s, I don't think that stocks have been trading on fundamentals for decades, literally. It's been much more of an emotional situation in the market, and there are those who have, you know, been consistent over the long term and they've done all right, and those who have chased hot performance or hot stocks have probably lost a lot of money, and those who stayed in money market probably lost even more. Because there's so many things to talk about there as far as interest rates. I mean, Social Security is huge. Those folks who are living on Social Security as their sole source, in some cases, of income, are really getting hurt because leaving out food, leaving out gas, leaving out some of the fundamentals of living from the inflation factor used to determine the rise in Social Security benefits is really hurting them in the bottom line. And the flip side of the coin is, you know, if they raise the rates on Social Security by 1 or 2% or even more, then that increases the debt and the faster that the Social Security bucket is going to run out. Mm-hmm. So there are so many moving issues that we have relating to what the real inflation rate is relating to all of those as well as income. And I can, from personal experience, in addition to what Rob has shared with us from his work with the bank and Small Business Administration, since Dodd-Frank went into place, getting a loan has become worse than buying a house, literally, and sometimes both if you're buying a house. But the documentation required, the numerical analysis that I have never seen happen before, the assets that they want to put on the line and put assignments on to loan you money has gotten to the point that it doesn't matter what interest rates are because you probably can't get the loan anyway.
they're great rates.
Yeah, they're great rates, but we don't give them to anybody. And that's been the case, you know, in talking with a variety of banks that it is so tough to get a loan regardless of the low rates that people give up, you know, and small business owners, I know, dealing with a lot of startups are having a lot of difficulty getting, unless they go to some, you know, some angel investors who have the money and understand how the markets and things work a little more than the banks are required to take into account under Dodd-Frank. So I'm hoping we can see some productive changes in that law in the upcoming, you know, months and years to reduce some of the restrictions and take it back to the basics of, you know, bank is there to make money, and they make money on deposits. They make money on lending money. They make money through some transaction fees. I'm not a real big fan of that one, but There are a lot more fees out there now. There are even banks who are virtual banks that they don't have any hard brick and mortar. There are no locations you can go to. They're strictly online. And I'm not a big fan of that myself, but it does happen out there. And just know what you're getting into, know what you're signing. That's all I can say about that, because as interest rates rise, it's going to be a little more expensive to get money. But if they can get some changes made for the right loans, it's going to be more cost effective in the long run.
Absolutely. So I remember when you talked about the tech bubble, I remember watching these companies come out. Red Hat was one that comes to mind, that these companies were trading at incredible premiums and they had no earnings.
No basis whatsoever.
It was all in speculation.
It's all hype.
When that finally came to a head, boy, did it come crashing down fast. And history tends to repeat itself. Snapchat is the latest one. And again, there's no earnings. It's traded on what people think or feel. So the fundamental part of it is really out the window because, well, one, they can't run any analysis on it until they report earnings. So
that's why they're not reporting earnings.
Exactly. Well, that's what happened. You're right. In the tech bubble, no one wanted to report earnings because then they knew that
there are none.
It was going to be or there wasn't enough. So and the last one is, I think there's probably some truth to this, that the would-be home buyers might get off the fence. Sure, they see rates going up. If they're really considering getting a loan and they're already approved, that they'll probably lock in sooner than later. So I can see some truth to that. I don't know if it's enough to swing markets or move markets or anything like that, but I can see that one being true. And the last point I want to make on this with regards to the national debt, since we're talking about it, how much do you think China holds? Because we always hear China owns all of our debt. How much do you think China holds out of our national debt?
I hesitate to even make a guess because, I mean, if I had to guess, and that's strictly what it is, I'd say they probably hold 40-50% of our national debt.
You know what? And you would be in a category that everyone else is in. But China actually holds less than 10% of our debt.
Really?
Our debt is held by Social Security. It's held by us. Social Security and Medicare, the non-discretionary piece of the budget, makes up the bulk. Rising very quickly is the debt service. And as rates continue to rise, that number will get larger and larger. But China holds less than 10%, and they probably hold less than they did last year because they continue to sell off some of the debt. So as we look for 2017 and for probably the couple years after that, we got to watch the tax, what the administration comes up with as far as a new tax program that we would have. How quickly the Fed rises rates. There seems to be a general consensus that there's going to be two more rate hikes this year. I'm not sure, but we will see what happens with that. So for at the end of the day, for our listeners out there, don't think that money market is a safe investment because you're losing purchasing power. If you do hold bonds, keep the term on the bond short. That way, as rates go up, if we do have two more rate increases, that you will you'll quickly be able, or more quickly be able to get into the bonds that are paying at the highest interest rate. Have a plan. Even if you're retired, you're still going to need some stock in that portfolio to stay ahead of inflation. So that wraps up the market segment. Now we move over to topic of the month. I can shut up now. We will get into disability insurance. I know enough to be dangerous. I know enough to get information rolling to turn it over to my partner, Larry Lexell here, and help people in this regard. But I do know it can be much more devastating than death. Most people will have some form of life insurance. So if you die, you got the life insurance that helps your survivors. But if you're disabled and you can't earn any more money, you're costing your family money because you are disabled, it can be devastating for a family that is not prepared or protected with disability insurance.
And it can be devastating very quickly. It's amazing how fast it can take someone who is even not just paycheck to paycheck, but who has a little nest egg put away and, you know, putting a little money away for retirement, how quickly that can turn on a disability. So let's talk about that a little bit, John. Why do you think, personal opinion, why do you think
you want my personal opinion? Is,
I do. I value your personal opinion, John.
But our opinions are not represented by anybody. Radio station, the university, or anyone else with sane mind. Just get a disclosure out there quickly.
That's why it's a personal opinion, John. we think what we think, and that's just the way it is. But why do you think that people are, in some cases, not aware of the need for disability insurance, and in other cases, not willing to spend the money?
I think people are, as even with life insurance, I think people are ignorant to the fact, in the true definition of ignorant, ignorant to the fact that it can quickly happen. And, you know, we have a, you know, not me mentality in this country, especially, that it's not going to happen to me. I don't need to pay for something, you know, car insurance. You know, I think a lot of, if it wasn't mandatory in a lot of cases, people wouldn't have car insurance. But you need, it's something that you need. And when it does happen, it's devastating, and they are just shocked that, oh, I didn't think this would happen to me. That's my personal opinion.
Well, car insurance is one of those things that is mandated by law, although there are many people out there, unfortunately, who ignore that law and choose not to be insured. And then if you are on the other side of that claim, you better hope that you have uninsured coverage that you get to pay for, by the way, to cover the fact that the other person didn't have insurance. But we won't go down that road right now. Disability insurance, the primary factor that I find is education. People don't understand disability insurance, which is why we're going to be talking about it at some length today. They don't understand the need, and they don't understand the reality of what can happen and why it happens. It's a situation that some of the facts, and you can go and Google it on the internet, but some of the facts out there that basically there's a 1 in 4 chance, a 25% chance of a 20-year-old today will become disabled before they reach retirement age at 65 or 66. So you have a 1 in 4 chance, and that is significantly higher, 2 to 3 times higher.
I thought it would be higher, but it's still pretty high.
Of a 25-year-old, yeah, 25% that you're going to be disabled between then and age 65. And the chance of death is significantly higher than that. In fact, if you talk about a couple of different possible outcomes, what do you think the odds are of an IRS audit today?
Less than 2%.
Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, you're pretty much right on. The odds today, if we're talking about facts, is you have a 1 in 104 chance of being the subject of an IRS audit. So that's 1/100th of a chance.
So we do have some good news on the show, folks. We do.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, so you have one less than 1% chance.
Nobody wants to go through that.
Slightly less than 1% chance of being audited by the IRS. And thinking out loud, how many of you have been audited by the IRS? So, you know, you're on borrowed time if you were one of the selected few. What about the odds today of being a victim of identity theft?
1 in 5, 1 in 7.
It's not quite that bad yet, but I think it's heading that way.
Given that it happened to me, I'm a little tainted.
Well, it happened to you and happened to me also, so that's 2 out of 2 right there, but about 1 in 14. So, you know, a little less than 10% chance of being a victim of identity theft in terms of the realm, and that's the Social Security Administration fact. It's, well, it's a year old, so.
And they're probably underreporting that, so.
Maybe even higher at this point. So disability, when you're looking about a 1 in 4 chance of becoming disabled over your lifetime, is, you know, you got a better chance of that than being a victim of identity theft or an IRS audit. So I would have to say that it's something that should be considered necessarily. I mean, nobody ever plans to become disabled. This month we're talking about the unforeseen, the unexpected things that happen. We've covered a number of those already with estate planning. We've talked about life insurance and the need for having proper documentation in place, as well as divorce. So, but disability is something people just don't want to talk about. What do you think the highest potential, what's the cause is what I would say. What is the primary cause of disability in the United States today?
I'm going to, well, broad categories.
Broad categories.
Health.
Yeah, no.
I'm torn between health or accidental, but I would go with health.
Well, today, 66% of American employees live from paycheck to paycheck, and they don't have enough savings to cushion themselves in the event of a disability. And, you know, they may be a good driver, they're pretty careful, they don't have a lot of accidents and whatnot, but the reality of it is that the majority of disabilities are caused from illness. And that can be broken.
Man, I'm hot today.
Yeah, you
this creme brulee is working.
Did you look at my notes, John?
I did not.
All right, okay. But the majority of people...
Going to go buy a lottery ticket.
We can stop on the way back, if you like. Yep. Only a small percent, 5% of disabling accidents and illnesses are work-related. So only 5% would be subject, if you will. Because I hear clients saying, oh, I've got work comp at work. Mm-hmm. That's the most likely place I'll get hurt. You know, I'm working a machine shop, auto tire shop, you know, physical labor, whatever, and I've got work comp, so I'm okay. Well,
only 5%
less than
work comp claims.
5% of all claims are subject or eligible legally to workman's compensation. Sorry, I had to throw that out there.
Speaking of fraud.
Yeah, speaking of fraud. But 5% or less are eligible for work comp. So work comp is not a fallback. We hope it never happens to you. You don't get hurt at work, but the chances are fairly minimal. And if it does, you're not going to get work comp because that is only in a very small majority of the cases. When you break it down into the claims that are filed by diagnosis, then the number one cause of disability is basically some type of musculoskeletal or connective tissue disease. We hear today about folks who are diagnosed at all ages. It could be in their 20s, 30s, 40s with many of the musculoskeletal diseases that affect us. And, you know, they can become debilitated to the point that they are incapable of walking and talking and whatnot. So there's a lot of those that are being treated. Number two, I was surprised, is cancer. I thought number one would be cancer, but it's not. It's musculoskeletal, almost by a 2-to-1 ratio. And then
I would guess cancer or heart attack.
Well, that's number two and three. You know, musculoskeletal connective tissue is number one at almost 30% of claims. Cancer is number two at 15%. Cardiovascular, so heart attacks, strokes are less than 9%.
Huh.
And then we go on down with nervous system related, 7%. Injuries and accidents, 10%. So it's a very minor portion. Maternity related comes in at about 6%. Mental disorder, psychiatric, about 8%. And then they lump everything else together. So the chances are 1 in 4, if you have four other colleagues working with you, one of you is going to become disabled during your lifetime. So the question is, what are you going to do about it, and why does it make a difference? Well, let's look at an example. It can be debilitating, not only physically and mentally and emotionally, but from strictly a financial standpoint, since this is the Financial Cafe, and we talk about good coffee from the chef shop. But let's take, for example, an average male, age 30, could be a female. If they were making, let's say they had a salary of $75,000 a year. So maybe they're in engineering, maybe they're in, you know, a higher socioeconomic area. And they were saving 5%, so they were putting away about $3,750 a year. Their monthly expenses are $4,000 a month, so about $48,000 a year.
They don't have any kids.
So they don't have any kids, you're right, because expenses would be twice that. And they need more money. So, you know, they make $75,000, they spend $48,000 for needs, basically. So every year that they would be completely disabled, they would have a deficit of $48,000, so about $50,000. And remember I said that they were saving about $3,750 a year for savings for that. What if, you know, we recommend 3 to 6 months of savings just in case something happens. Well, 1 year of disability wipes out 13 years of savings. So if they had not been saving for at least 13 years, they would not have the money to even survive 1 year of disability. And when you look at the number of years being disabled, if they were disabled for 4 years, for example, that's $192,000 in expenses, then the years of savings needed to offset that is 51 years to offset 4 years of disability. So being on disability and not having the income, particularly in a one-income family, and even in a two-income family, if you sat down and really analyzed, you know, did what we recommend all the time, that you have a plan, it's in writing, you have specific time frames, objectives, your budget, part of that, that you implement it and you monitor it, you're going to find out that you may not be able to live on one income. And that's the question, what would happen if that income was quickly taken away for an extended period of time? And, you know, even nominal savings, a 5% savings per year, we're not talking about 401k, we're just talking about putting money away on the side in the event of that what if, that 4 years of disability can eat up 51 years of savings. And that's just, when you stop to think about it, it's kind of mind-boggling that it would take that much to offset such a short period of time. So disability does happen, happens probably, I guess you would say, when you least expect it. So disability coverage is something that you need to consider. When you're building that into a budget, where do you start? Well, the best place to start is take a look at the what if in terms of what your needs are. So by taking your current income, your wages that you bring home from your job, adding in the annual contributions, your tax-deferred savings to a 401k, 403b, 125 plan, any pre-contributions that you make to medical or child care costs, bonuses, commissions, that type of thing, that's your total income. If you multiply that figure by 75%, then that brings you back to generally what you're going to need in disability insurance to offset that loss of income going forward. And a lot of people, I hear the comment also, well, I've got coverage at work. You know, the group disability, it covers me, right? And I said, well, you have to take a look at that, because oftentimes group disability, there's a couple of things you need to look at in the contract, is what is the elimination period, how long before it starts paying. And that can be anywhere from immediate, I don't see a lot of those, but, 30, 60, 90 days, which means that first quarter or so, you're going to have to come up with the money that it doesn't provide. And in many cases, it only provides benefit of a limited amount. So what percentage of your income does it cover? One of the most common mistakes when I'm dealing with people who are in incentivized jobs, commission-related, is most group insurance, disability insurance, may not include your commission. So if you're on a base salary of $30,000 and you make another $30,000 in commission selling whatever, cars, furniture, boats, electronics, copiers, it doesn't matter what it is, you find out if that group insurance covers more than your base salary, because in many cases it does not. And if it's paying 60% of your now $30,000 salary, you're going to have $18,000 coming in to offset a potential $60,000 loss in income. Those numbers just don't work. So you've got
That's government numbers there.
Yes, government numbers. Yeah, trust us, you're covered. So you need to know what you are going to get from your group disability, what it includes, the elimination period, what it will include as far as base salary, commission, bonus, vacation. Those types of things are all defined in the contract. So get a copy of it, take a look at it. And once you've determined that, subtract that from your 75% of the number we talked about a minute ago. That's what you need in terms of after-tax benefit from a group or from an individual disability policy. Surprisingly, individual disability is not necessarily as expensive as many people think it is. So it's a good idea to start taking a look at it and determine, if I have a 1 in 4 chance of becoming disabled for an extended period of time, what am I going to do? How am I going to offset that? And people come up with all kinds of solutions. Maybe I can borrow some money from family and friends. And well, that may be true, but unless they're independently wealthy, that may come to an end.
So probably a good part or place to go to now is to cover some of the more common definitions, parameters, terms. So in essence, we have short-term and long-term disability coverages. Your short-term usually goes out about 6 months, would you say, Larry, on average?
Short-term, 6 months to a year. Yeah, okay. That's not unusual.
And then after that, your long-term would kick in. We have group short-term and long-term. That's usually where you get it through your employer. And if you have that ability where that your employer is offering short-term and long-term disability, absolutely take it. But as you had just mentioned, you can also get individual short-term and long-term. The premiums and so forth may be a little bit higher, but you still can get that coverage if you cannot get it through your employer. And what I find tricky, like any insurance contract or policy or something that an attorney writes, it's never clear. It's always clear as mud, but non-cancelable and guaranteed renewable. Please explain that to me, Larry.
Yes, John, I would be happy to explain that to you. Non-cancelable is a type of coverage typically to age 65, because again, we're talking about disability insurance, most of which ends at age 65. There are a few that you can extend to 67 and 70, but that's about it. It means that as long as you pay your premium on time, the insurance carrier will not cancel your coverage or increase your premium you continuing your benefit. So non-cancelable is as long as you pay your premium, it's your coverage, and even if you have subsequently developed an illness or something that would lead to disability, they cannot cancel it as long as you pay the money. Now, guaranteed renewable is where rates can be changed. So it's guaranteed renewable, but the company is not guaranteeing that it will be at the same rate that you are currently. They can't single you out because you got cancer or because you became ill or whatever, but they can raise that entire rate class. So you and maybe thousands, tens of thousands of other people who bought a particular series of coverage, a particular group, they can raise the price on the entire group, and you have no control over that. So guaranteed renewable is different than non-cancelable. Non-cancelable is better because they can't raise the premium, and as long as you pay it, you're good to go.
So have you seen a situation where they've, you know, again, the skeptic in me, you had a rate class that was very high, and the insurance company wanted to get out of that business, where they raise the rates for that whole class to where it almost gets impossible to renew? Or are there some parameters that they can only raise at a certain percentage of the existing premium?
Well, any change in premium for any rate class of a coverage or policy for an insurance carrier has to be submitted to the State Department of Insurance and be justified in terms of losses that have been incurred and so forth. Honestly, the top four or five companies, all of which we deal with, who have the top ratings from all of the agencies in 25 plus years, I have never seen them go back and raise a class. So I can't say that they wouldn't under a guaranteed renewable policy raise a class premium, but they could. But I think the better companies that have underwritten the policy properly through the underwriting process have sufficient reserves to cover the predictable occurrence of the benefit being paid out. So don't see that too often.
Okay. So another common term or definition would be the waiting period. And that's the amount of time that you're basically on your own before you get coverage. And looking at the notes I have written here, it could be anywhere from 30 days to 2 years for the long-term disability. Have you seen a two-year?
I have.
And my gosh.
Obviously, it's part of the financial plan that we've talked about earlier on the show. You know, your plan has to look at how much can you self-insure, which is basically what we're talking about. If you have the assets, if you have an inheritance, for example, or if you won a lottery, for example, or if you have just been a meticulous saver and you have several hundred thousand dollars sitting in CDs. And I have clients who do have that. Not the best place to put it, but that's a small portion of their investment. So that's the conservative part of it. They could survive up to a year or two of no income without tapping into their retirement or other specific savings. So they could use a two-year delay or period in which before the coverage kicks in. Most commonly is if they have some type of short-term coverage, then it's going to kick in when the short-term coverage ends at 6 months or a year. is the most prominent. If there is no short-term coverage and it's an individual who has no savings and no other way of paying, putting food on the table literally or paying the bills, then, you know, you may opt for that 6 month or 90-day wait period and self-insure the first 90 days or 6 months, and that's when the disability kicks in. Because the reality of it is, when you're dealing with disabilities, there are a lot of disabilities that people come back to work in less than 6 months. You know, someone can have a mild, and none of them are inconsequential by any means, but they can have a mild stroke, they can have a mild heart attack, they can have an injury to a tendon or leg or foot, and it might put them out of work for even 3 or 4 months, but it's the exception where they do go past 6 months. So if you're looking for the exception rather than the rule and you can self-insure that first period of 3 to 6 months, then you start the coverage at that point in time.
Let's talk about the occupation, own occupation, and all occupation. And then after that, I want to touch on the insurance companies know how expensive this is, and they have written a lot of features into these contracts to incentivize people to get back to work. But let's talk about the damages that can be incurred by just the policy that you have, whether it's all occupation or own occupation.
Well, it's a very important characteristic. Once you've selected the right company or companies to give you some quotes on disability insurance that have the best ratings, and you know that you have a policy that's non-cancelable, so they can't raise your premiums as long as you continue to pay, then you get into the definition of when do you get benefit. ONOC is commonly what's called in the industry that says if you are working in a specific definable occupation. And the example I always refer to is a real example of my brother sold a group of anesthesiologists in the local metro area policies back in the late 60s, early 70s that said as long as they could act in a capacity of an anesthesiologist, then they would be fine. But if they became disabled for any reason, as one did during my tenure in taking care of the client, and he had a stroke, and he could no longer practice as an anesthesiologist because having your or my life in his hands on the table was not an acceptable risk that he could, again, have a stroke or an episode and not be able to perform his duties. So he no longer could work in his own occupation as an anesthesiologist. He was perfectly capable, and he continued on to have a successful family practice. But he could not own, he could not work in his own occupation, and that cut his income, believe it or not, by as much as 50%. So the policy did kick in. It started paying him a significant benefit on a monthly basis, and that continued the policy that he had. Actually, was written for life, so that income would continue for a very long period of time, even though he could work. And to some, work in a capacity as a physician with a decent income, but he could not work in his own occupation. So knowing the definition of own occupation, and then a lot of policies will limit that payment of ONOC. So more of the policies today would say that if you are precluded from working in your own occupation for up to, might be 2 years, up to 5 years, for example, not a lot of them will take you out to age 65 in an ONOC situation. So they'll pay you for not working in your own occupation for a period of years. And at that point, if you can do something else, then the policy will quit paying. So a lot of the benefits of these policies early on have been more limited because of usage. There's been a lot more people who have found themselves in need of benefit, and the insurance companies and being able to protect their clients and not raise the rates on older policies have limited the type of benefit that ONOC has paid. So again, defining that exactly as to what own occupation means and how long it's going to pay is critical to the benefit of the policy.
And we need to remember too that these benefits that we're talking about aren't at 100%. They're usually at some reduced percentage, and I know we touched on that earlier, but I wanted to remind everyone that these are at a reduced amount to begin with.
Yeah, it is not intended to replace 100% of your income. If it did, no one would ever go back to work. So generally speaking, you can get somewhere.
You mean there's fraud in this
there's
industry?
There's some fraud, yeah. There, okay. You generally can replace somewhere between 60 and 70% of your income through disability, but they want to make it that you have an incentive to go back to work to replace 100% of your income. So if, for example, you have a group policy, you may need something that we call gap coverage. So your group policy maybe pays you 40% of your benefit, or as we spoke earlier, it may only pay 60% of your base salary and not commission. So now you have a bigger gap, as it were. So to provide gap coverage, we would say, okay, if you became disabled, your group coverage will pay you 40%. We'll do an individual policy that provides an additional 20 or 25%, and we'll get you up to that 60 or 65% of your total income, including base salary, commissions, et cetera, so that you can indeed live, because most people, when you run a budget, they spend, you know, a good 60 to 70, 80% of their income. So if that goes away and it's not replaced, that could be a definite issue.
Yeah. And again, like we said in the beginning of the show, disability can be more devastating than death quite easily.
Well, financially, it certainly is.
So looking at some of, well, as we were talking about, we know that this is expensive. We know that this is devastating, and the insurance companies certainly do. But I'm looking at a couple bullet points here that are provisions to help encourage employees to return to work. So the insurance company certainly wants you to get back. One was a reasonable accommodation expense benefit, and this reimburses employers up to $25,000 for approved worksite modifications that are made on behalf of a disabled employee so that employee can return to work. Have you come across that in your vast years of experience?
My vast years. I've come across just about everything, John.
Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of riders and benefits, and that can be applied to homes as well as to work. If someone were to become disabled, that it would allow for modification of the home in terms of ramps, in terms of a restroom facility that would accommodate a wheelchair, or hallways that need to be made wider to accommodate a wheelchair, or that type of traveling method, that the policies will provide additional benefit up to a certain limit to make those modifications at home. The same thing can apply to a vehicle. If someone is restricted to a wheelchair and they need a vehicle to be able to get around, modifying a vehicle for wheelchair accessibility and also for driving if they are capable of doing that. It may get into, to a certain extent, the definition of disability. We did talk a little bit about that. Social Security has a very strict definition of disability in terms of you cannot be able to perform any type of work in any capacity anywhere in the world, whether or not the job's available or not. So it's kind of like, government work. So the disability applications are very difficult to get approved. And very difficult to keep because they do fraud detection protection to make sure that people truly are not able to perform duties when they say they can't. But it gets into the definition of partial disability. Again, what does the contract say of paying a benefit due to sickness or injury when you can't maintain your usual work schedule, but you can perform some of the duties of your occupation? And you only lose a portion of your income. The better policies will say that there's a pro rate, a percentage, if you can perform 50% of the duties. If you had a $50,000 job and you can earn $25,000, then the policy encourages you to go back to work to earn the $25,000, and they'll make up the difference. So you can get paid when you are partially disabled on some policies, but that is a rider to give you an extended partial disability benefit. That gives you several options in calculating how to maintain benefit payment during your recovery, because they do incent you to go back to work and to get back at your primary, goes back to the primary occupation again, if possible.
And I see some of these policies will pay that if you cannot go back to your own occupation, but they will pay for education, training, family care, job search, and other job-related expenses to get you back to work, even though it may not be what you were your job was originally.
Well, that
and you kind of touched on that with the doctor who was an anesthesiologist and went into family practice.
I mean, there are a lot of way more options and benefits, and they vary somewhat by company. Again, on a lot of policies, you could elect a benefit rider dealing with future insurability. This is particularly if you're in a career where you may come out of school, and we'll talk about that next, actually, is student loan coverage, because that's a biggie today. But you may come out of school as a physician or an attorney or, heck, today, and in many professions, where your initial income may be not what it's going to grow to be. So you may come out of school and you're making 30, 40 grand a year initially, but your ultimate salary may be double or even triple that. Then you can include a future insurability option on the policy so that you are guaranteed, even if you became uninsurable, because it is an underwritten product, that you became uninsurable through illness or injury, accident, whatever it happens to be, that the policy would allow you to add additional coverage at a future date, specific increments, maybe every 5 years or so, that you can get additional coverage even if you are uninsurable at that point. There is a benefit increase rider also that will automatically increase coverage based on a number of years in a certain occupation. Again, we see it a lot with physicians, attorneys, where it's expected their income will go up the more time that they have in that occupation. And one of the keys of those benefits is that they are provided without proof of need, without proof of medical re-underwriting. So you're guaranteeing against future illness, basically, in some of those cases. So let's talk about insurability as far as the future, because coverage for college debt, if you're a recent college graduate, you're beginning your career, you have fairly sizable loan debt, defaulting on your loan is probably not a good idea. But, you know, someone who comes out of school and it happens more often than we'd like to think, but they're diagnosed with cancer and all of a sudden they can't work, they can't make payments, then there are disability coverages to help offset the cost of paying back your student loan. So it's something to consider, particularly if it's sizable. If you're in a six-figure range for a student loan, maybe you want to be prepared to provide some coverage for that. And also there are companies that provide the continuation of your retirement benefit. So let's take that example of that $75,000 a year worker, and maybe he was putting 10%, as he should, into his retirement plan. So that's $7,500 a year. The loss of putting that money away over a lifetime can be several million dollars for their retirement. So there are products available to say that, you know, if you are consistently putting away the maximum, the $18,000 for those 50 and under, or $24,000 deferral into a retirement plan, and you become disabled, then the company will continue to make that payment on your behalf throughout your lifetime so that when you reach retirement, you still have a nest egg sitting there waiting for you. So it's another way of protecting the future, even though you may only be able to replace with disability insurance 60% of your income. That may not allow for maxing out that retirement plan contribution, but there are benefit riders that will allow you to take that into account to maintain that continuous income contribution. Disability insurance is an interesting product. It's one with which we hope we never need it. It's kind of like car insurance. You know, I hope I never need it, but if I do, it better be there, because I've seen more than one family destroyed from disability where the husband or wife, it doesn't matter which, and if we talk about women today, you know, women control about 90% of the spending today, as a statistical analysis has shown. So
I'm not going there.
I'm
not going there.
So if your spouse is a working woman and they lose the ability to work, then coverage for them is as important, if not even more so, than the other individual. So you have to look at it as part of a total plan. And one of the questions and one of the things I like about our software, the Money Guide Pro software, And we don't get any endorsement for that, but it's a good package. Is it allows us to play what-if games. We can put all the parameters in. This is your income. This is expected rate of inflation. This is the expected rate of income increasing over time. Well, what if at age 40 you became totally disabled for a period of 5 years? What does that do to your plan? So now you're not funding retirement. You know, if you didn't have replacement from a disability policy, are you going to drain down all of your savings, which, as we talked earlier, happens very, very quickly? You know, just a couple years of disability can drain down 15 years or more of savings. So what do you actually do at that particular point in time? So it is a piece of the puzzle. It's a tool that we use in terms of meeting the goals of the individual. And every situation is different. There are different types of disability coverages. We mentioned early in the show about the return of premium coverage. I certainly would encourage you to consider it. It is more expensive. The premium that you pay today is a little higher than a policy without return of premium. But at the end of that period of time, when you terminate the policy, you get all your premiums back. So it alleviates the issue for some that say, you know, I'm paying all this money. I don't think I hope I never need it. Don't think I will. So I don't want to pay it. Well, if you happen to be that one person who needs it, then you're going to wish you had. And as, you know, planners who are obligated to take into account all of the what ifs in your particular situation, we're going to recommend you consider disability insurance of some type to at least supplement what you have at work. So the first thing you have to do there is know what you have at work and understand what it does and, more importantly, does not cover for your future. So it's an important aspect, one to take a look at. I wasn't sure we were going to get a full hour out of this, but we certainly did, John.
Oh, we can take care of talking, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
And, you know, kind of touching on what you had mentioned, it certainly is probably the least definable or tricky to define coverages. I mean, death, life insurance is, you know, you're dead, you're dead. You know, car insurance, you're in an accident. But this one, there are so many variables, and you really need to be paying attention to the contract, the language that's being used, and make sure that you understand all the provisions, not necessarily what's in your policy, but what's available. There may be some things out there that you just don't know.
And one of the things we did not talk about that I'll mention quickly, if I can do that.
Not possible.
I know, is family history. You know, if you have a family history of diabetes, cancer, whatever it happens to be, you may have talked to your physician. I mean, they're the primary on it, but there may be concerns that, you know, you have a genetic predisposition to certain disabilities. And if that's the case, I sure as heck would get some disability coverage to accommodate that. I mean, it's playing a game of roulette, so to speak. Well, you need it or not, but if you don't need it and you have it, you've spent a little money. If you need it and you don't have it, you're maybe bankrupt.
You're in big trouble. Well, that wraps up our topic of the week. I hope everyone found it informational. If you have questions or, you know, want some more information, you can go to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us. Larry's contact information and my contact information is out there. That is a great way to reach us. And with that in mind, next week, I want to get this out there before Larry tries to pull a prank on me.
Come on.
But next week is April 1st, so the show will be on April Fool's Day. And we will have a fun show with that, kind of lighthearted. I certainly have an April Fool's joke that I will share that I pulled on someone that and if you have one that you would like to share, please go out to our website, www.thefinancialcafe.us. Share your story, and we'll be sure to mention it on our show next week. But so what strange news story do you have, sir?
I just can't get past some of these stupid criminals, John. I mean,
you are set in a...
I know. I get boring on some things, but this was again. And they're not unique to the U.S. This one comes out of a non-American, let's see where it was. It was Canada. Okay, I'll pick on Canada again.
We don't have the same story because I got a monk on meth.
Okay, well, this is from Canada. There was a victim, and she had reported that her jewelry was missing. The electronics were gone. The window was smashed. You know, she was historical when the officer Maharu of the Calgary police arrived. Her French-speaking father happened to call her on the phone at the time, and speaking in French, she explained her father that the policeman was there, and it really was all a scam that she was running to gather the insurance money from the things that she said she lost. She didn't realize that the officer spoke six different languages, including French. Needless to say, the report was not about the missing items.
Oh, wow. I would love to be a fly on the wall with some of these stories just to see the person's reaction when they actually get busted.
Yeah, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, you know, the police officer turned around and says, bonjour. So anyway, I have one. Do you ever wonder what monks do? You see the, you know, besides living in these huge monasteries, and depending on the country, with gazillions of monkeys or whatever running around. But what do they do all day? I mean, a person can only pray or meditate for so long. So what do these guys do all day? And you think with a monk, it's going to be something good and wholesome. But we have here is a Buddhist monk. And the title is charged with stashing 4 million meth pills. It actually was 400,000 that was worth $4 million.
Wow.
But the monk stored, and there's a picture of the police officers with 400,000 meth pills, as well as hand grenades, automatic weapons, and so forth.
Well, you got to have a hobby, John. I mean, you know.
Good grief. So grenade, ammunition. What I thought was funny was the religious affairs ministry person, So Min Tun, said, it's not a very common case, but not impossible to happen.
Sure, John. Okay.
So there we go. Now we know what the monks are doing. They're popping a whole lot of meth, and good grief. Right,
let's not categorize here. But our thanks to the Chef Shop, both Nancy and Scott Schneider out there. Go by, visit them. They have some great stuff this spring. They're 2320 Troy Road, Edwardsville, Illinois, 62025. Phone number, give them a call, 618-659-9840. Let them know that you heard us. If we don't have our coffee cups there yet, let them take your name. We'll get one to you as soon as they have been produced and delivered.
Should be a couple weeks away from that.
So we're not too far away. You might get a T-shirt also. So go visit them. The creme brulee was the coffee of choice today. They're all good. I have no problem.
As far as their frou-frou goes, I think this one's my favorite frou-frou.
That's one of your favorite? Okay.
Well, favorite frou-frou.
As long as it's good, John. That's what it works. So. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to WSIE, Steve Jankowski, Daryl, our engineer, in terms of helping us put the show on. And thanks to the university here on the Southern Illinois University campus, WSIE FM 88.7, The Sound. We hope you join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. for a little information about financial affairs, a little information about some good coffee, and just a little information, John. So we'll wrap things up. Say goodbye, John.
Goodbye, John.
You've been listening to The Financial Cafe, airing every Saturday at 9 a.m. on 88.7 WSIE The Sound. Today's show is underwritten by The Chef Shop in Edwardsville, your hometown kitchen accessory store, where a good cup of coffee starts every day right. Listeners are invited to send your questions regarding retirement, investments, or any other financial topic that may pique your interest. Send the questions to John at jgraney@nickelfinancial.com or to Larry at lexo@nickelfinancial.com. John and Larry will discuss those questions each week during their Q&A session. If you prefer, they will respond to you in private. Thanks for listening to The Financial Cafe on 88.7 WSIE The Sound.